Really a blessing to be with you and to get the warmth of the fellowship and the reverberations of all of the happy, married people here. I can tell it's different from the usual family life seminar audience, I'll tell you. And even, no matter what we try to do in advertising our seminars, we can't get around the fact that to a person out in Mobile, Alabama that sees the picture and the advertisement for the first time, the inclination is, well, this is just for those whose marriages are on the rocks. And it isn't true, but you'd be amazed when I get there on Friday nights, I get that feeling. You know, they sit about this far apart, and they snarl at each other. And then some of the reports we get that after it's all over and what the Lord has done, we have them fill out a little questionnaire evaluation form. And sure enough, a high percentage of the people that come are having problems, and I just sense that. I don't sense that tonight. I sense a warmth of love, and I guess you've come to see just how many things you've been doing right. I hope that's true, because I announced Sunday I'm going to talk to you tonight about an exciting subject, how to keep love alive. I don't know anyone in this country that gets married because they want to be miserable, but I know a lot of people that achieve it. You don't have to try to achieve that. All you have to do is ignore the fundamental rules that brought you together the first place. Now, how do you keep love alive? Well, really, it's just a matter of continuing to do the things that you did before you were married, only with a little more depth and a little more gusto and over a longer period of time. No one would treat a person selfishly and inconsiderately and expect that person to be won by their charms. Instead, we all have a natural built-in way of treating a person before marriage. And what I'd like to talk to you about tonight is something that I'm sure you're all aware of, but I'm going to give you some suggestions on how to continue doing what you did before you were married, because when you do so, the end result is going to be to perpetuate love. And isn't that what makes life in marriage a wonderful experience? We have many couples in our church that really love each other. And they're an inspiration to all of us. You just sense it when you're in their presence. And you'll find, as I go over the list that I've made up, the reason is because they're doing some things right. You see, nothing just happens. I wish you could have a garden without planting it, without cultivating it, and most of all, without weeding it. But one of the reasons I'm not a farmer is, well, first of all, I don't have a green thumb. Everything I plant dies. And second of all, I just detest it. I think the plants get the reverberations that I don't like farming. I don't like growing things except, you know, grass that doesn't have to be cut and watered and all that sort of thing. I like it when someone else takes care of it and trees, but none of that, you know, putzy stuff that takes a lot of care. And consequently, every lawn I've ever had showed it. You get out of a thing just what you put into it. Now, when it comes to marriage, we want to be loved. That's one of the reasons we got married. And we want to love. God has made love in the human heart to be an expressive thing. And if you love someone so much that you never get a chance to express that love, it's almost as if your heart would burst under the pressure of trying to get that love out. And that's why God has designed us for marriage. And when you boil it all down, it really doesn't matter what you have and what you've done. If you don't have a good marriage, you've really missed it all. I know there are in our audience tonight some people who have had good marriages, and the Lord has seen fit to take your loved one to be with Himself. But you can identify with what I'm saying tonight because you can remember back to the days when you had a wonderful, good marriage. And you wouldn't trade those memories for a poor marriage in companionship now. Because there's something enriching about loving and being loved by the object of your love. But in order to have that kind of a relationship, you have to obey certain basic principles. I think that they're principles God has put on the heart of people, and if they're taught to be unselfish in life, they will automatically do it. And they're also taught in the Word of God. Just like the conscience parallels the law of God. Now, it isn't exactly like the law of God, but it parallels the law of God. People know intuitively what to do as far as rights and wrongs are concerned. So it is in the relationship of following certain principles about expressing love. And so I'd like to give you several points. I won't tell you how many, because if I told you, you'd all groan, because the list just kept growing and growing and growing the more I thought about it. And I'd like to ask you to get out a pencil and a paper and write down some of these things. They're so good, you're going to want to keep them. And I don't want you to forget some of these things. Sure. Tom, well, you don't have to talk. You sound like the freshman in college. Tom says that if you don't have any paper, use some of that napkin, if there's any clean spaces on it. All right, number one. Now, let's begin at the beginning. Number one, if you're going to keep your love alive, you, number one, have to develop spiritual attractiveness. I think that's the place for Christians to begin. Love is a result of our relationship to God. And in order to be a giver of love, you have to have it to give. And that is determined by developing spiritual attractiveness. I'd like to emphasize the importance of this, and I put it first because, in my opinion, it is first. And I'm assuming that, number one, you know Christ as your personal Savior, and you have access to the dimension that is eclipsed by the world. The world just doesn't even pay attention to this. As you know, man is body, soul, and emotion. Body, soul, and emotion. And if you go to the public school or if you go in the secular world, that's all they talk about. Body, soul, and emotion. Now, in the body, body, mind, and emotion. And the mind of man that is inundated with all kinds of information is given everything in the world except the importance of the fourth dimension. That's the spiritual dimension of life. And the reason the world today is in such a confusion, and the reason that secular counselors are not really helping people on a lasting basis with any high degree of success. I think I read recently where psychotherapy is effective 35% of the time. Well, some years ago I read nothing over a two-year period is successful 50% of the time. So I'm a little bit suspicious about its success. In any case, the reason this is true is because they do not deal with the fourth dimension of man, the spiritual side of man's nature. Now, if you cultivate that spiritual person, you will find that it will improve your physical, the way you look, and the way you think, and that all-important area of the way you feel. Everyone wants to feel properly today, but they're not willing to pay the price of spiritual maturity to feel properly. You see, guilt, just one thing, wipes us out of the feeling department. If you feel guilty, then you have real problems with the proper emotions. Now, if you're right before God and you're developing spiritual attractiveness, number one, by obedience to God, the Word of God, the filling of the Holy Spirit, and assuming, of course, you've received Christ, then you're going to be the kind of person that has love to give. God is the giver of love. And let's face it, we're going to be married, according to the plan of God, if the Lord Jesus tarries, and live together longer as two individuals than we do as a family. And that's why it's imperative that we have love from God to give to another person. All right, develop spiritual attractiveness. Now, second, develop or continue to develop physical attractiveness. Now, that sounds kind of odd, doesn't it? But remember, I told you that we just continue to do the things that we did before marriage. Any of you fellas let your beard grow? Now, this is back in the days when it wasn't as fashionable as it is now. But did you let your beard grow in a little stubble and wear your dirtiest clothes and never comb your hair when you went out to pick up your girlfriend, assuming she's the one you're married to now? Is that the way you dressed for a date with her? No, as I recall so vividly, it was the one time you wore out the carpet or the linoleum in front of the bathroom mirror. The one time you shaved nicks and scars on your face, and it's the one time you got your shoe polishing kit out and polished your shoes. And you know what I can even remember doing? This sounds like 1,000 years ago. I can even remember trying to iron a crease by myself in a pair of flannel pants. No one had ever told me it was an exercise in futility, but I can remember trying. And it was because of that desire to become physically attractive to another person. Isn't it interesting how we change that after marriage? Or should I say, some people do. They lose interest. They get the idea that, well, now that I'm married and I've got their name on a sheet of paper, why, they have to put up with me no matter what I look like. Now, it's true, most of us don't have much to work with to begin with. But we ought to do the best we can with what we've got. And men, I think women are far wiser than we in that regard. Or at least they are when they come to church. I'm not exactly sure they do that at home. From some of the stories I hear, one fellow said, you know, my wife wears curlers, seems like, all the time I'm home. In fact, she looks like she just stuck her finger in the electric socket. I suggest that whatever time you get spruced up, you get spruced up when you're together. Because really, what other people think of you and how other people commend you is not really so important as how you look to the person you love most. And then third, may I suggest a very important characteristic if you're going to keep your love alive, and that is to verbalize your love daily. Everyone has to be loved. It's a basic need in the heart of all human beings, or at least all normal human beings and all honest human beings. Everyone wants to be loved. And the more we love a person, the more we desire their love and the more we desire to have it verbalized. There are two reasons we should verbalize love. One is that it helps the object of the verbalization, and second, it helps us to love the person. Now, that may sound like double talk, but it's true. The more you tell a person that you love them, the easier it is to love them, because you don't want to be a liar. And it somehow, when you verbalize it, it stamps itself indelibly on your mind. And it is so reassuring to another person to hear their partner say, I love you. And men, some of you guys look like you've just turned into skeletons or emotional spastics. Really, what's wrong with telling your wife that you love her? I'm astonished at the number of men that find that difficult to do. So many big, hulking guys say, well, you know, I show it in a lot of ways. I'm reminded of the brilliant engineer from out at Convair some years ago who was dragged in here by one of the men. His wife had run off with someone else and left him with five children. And here's a man pacing up and down in front of my desk. And he said, I just can't understand that woman. He said he had already told me he made $15,500 a year. He had an IQ of 148, and his wife only had an IQ of 132. And as he's pacing up and down in front of my desk, he said, I just can't understand that woman. I've given her everything she wanted. He said, I gave her a new car, and I gave her new carpeting. She didn't like our house, so we sold it and got another house. He said, anything she wanted, I gave her. And I never met the lady. But in his own words, he had given me all this information. And he said, you know, about 10 years ago, she was always on my back because I wouldn't tell her I loved her. But he said, I thought that was so silly. You know, just kids do that. And so he said, I quit. For 10 years, I hadn't told her I loved her. And so, in fact, he finally concluded, of course I loved her. Said, I gave her five kids. I thought, that's typical masculine wisdom. The tragic thing about it was she ran off with a fella, a sailor, who made $285 a month that looked enough like him to be his brother. What does that tell you? Here's a girl who probably was graduated from her Wisconsin high school class, magna cum laude, went to college, and there was only one person in that class that could best her. For the first time in her life, she found someone that was just a little ahead of her. She fell in love with him, married him, and then she started having babies, and he went off to become an engineer and fulfill his vocation, and he began neglecting her. And what did she want? Just to have him reassure her that he loved her. And he was too selfish to consider what she needed. You see, the fact that it may have been kind of silly to him may realistically have been true. Maybe his background was so warped and his parents so peculiar that they never exchanged such verbal expressions of love. Consequently, he grew up in a maladjusted home. Possibly so. But you see, all of those Freudian excuses could have been nullified if he had just been unselfish enough to say, well, so it's kind of silly to me, but it means something to her, and she means so much to me. And the agony on his face indicated she did now that she was gone, that he could do that. Men, women particularly, love to be reassured that they are loved by you. And really, when you get down to it, hasn't she taken the biggest risk? I never cease to marvel that a sweet young thing, 18 to 24 or somewhere thereabouts, will literally take her life in her hands and put it in yours. You know, what a risk it is. You may never have amounted to anything. She could be saddled forever with misfortune, depending on the rise and fall and the consistency or the erratic behavior of one man, you. Now, let me ask you men a question. Would you have taken such a risk? Not on your life. But they did. And they do it year after year. My next wedding will be 429. And they're lining up for this summer to do it. So I just never cease to be amazed at these gals and their faith, that kind of faith in a young man wet behind the ears certainly deserves to be rewarded with love. Verbalize your love daily. Fourth, physically express your love. Physically express your love. Now, I'm not going to take the time in this wonderful audience to talk to you about the physical sublimities of the harmony that God has designed in the interchange of marriage according to the sanctified plan of God. What I'm talking about now is just physical contact. In fact, it's very important to be physical about your relationship. I've noticed that I can almost tell where a couple is in the marital ball game by their physical contact when I see them just casually. When a man feels so comfortable about his wife that he can just reach out and put his hand on her arm, or put his hand on her shoulder, or take her elbow when they're stepping across the curb, or in some way, just those little physical contacts. Do you know what a physical contact means? It shows identification. It shows approval. It shows oneness. And when you don't have that inner peace and that rapport and that sense of belonging, pardon me, there's a reluctance to just be that free. For example, if your partner freezes up on you, you begin to withdraw and you lose that sense of freedom. And very honestly, I think that the sublime relationship of husband and wife that I like to refer to as the act of marriage should be the ultimate consummation of many little physical expressions of love in a given day. And then the physical expression is what God intended it to be. Be physical in your expression in accord with the circumstances and the place where you are. Now, don't get carried away in church. Fifth, be sure and write this one down. Be kind, and considerate of each other. Be kind and you want me to spell it? Be kind and considerate of each other. You know, the second description or definition of love in the Bible is love is kind. And love is kind. In fact, love is never inconsiderate. Love is very sensitive to the needs of another person. And the kindness that you express to your partner should be that which is in accord with their individual need. Love is kind. Love doesn't seek its own. Love is considerate about the needs of the other person. And you see, the opposite of love, self-love, is selfish. Self-love is always selfish, and it's unkind. It's going to express itself in a selfish outpouring of self-protection, and that never produces love. If you're going to keep your love alive, be kind and considerate. We had a couple that went to be with the Lord. In fact, the only time in all the years I've been in the ministry I've ever performed a funeral service for a couple at the same time. Some of you folks who've been here for years remember Mr. and Mrs. Frank Glena. They were a devoted couple to Jesus Christ, to each other, and to this church. And I always remember them. I'll never forget being in their home after they had celebrated their 56th wedding anniversary. I think they were close to 75, somewhere in there, when they went to be with the Lord. In any case, when Bev and I stopped by to see them and congratulate them, it was in their little home out in Lemon Grove, and he pointed to her and he said, "Pastor, she's more beautiful now than the day we married." And as he said that, I turned to look at her, and right behind her was their wedding picture. And there she was as a bride, dressed in white. And, you know, my eyes were 20/20 in those days, and I could see a tremendous difference. But he couldn't. He had 20/80 vision where she was concerned. He looked at her, and she was the most beautiful thing that ever lived. And do you know that kind of treatment? And anyone who knew them knew that they were very considerate of each other, so sensitive to each other's needs. They never had children. They just had each other for 56 years and dearly loved each other. If one of them got a pain, the other hurt. They were that close. And I believe, if my memory serves me correctly, he was only ill 9 months. She tended his illness. He died on a Friday, quite suddenly. And she grieved on Saturday. And on Sunday, her daughter had flown out to be with her, a friend. I think they had helped to raise a girl that kind of thought of herself as their daughter. And sitting at their breakfast table, she just sighed and went to sleep 2 days after he passed away. And she had already said, "You know, now that Frank's gone, there really is no purpose for me to live." And so we held the funeral over a day, and I think on Tuesday we had a praise service for two lovers who loved Jesus and loved each other. I can't think of a better illustration of two people who spent their 56 years being kind and considerate to each other. And by the way, can you think of a better way to separate after 56 years? And then, six, may I suggest that you be forgiving. Be forgiving. As much as we all love those dear folk, I dare say they did things that exasperated each other and had to be forgiven. And I would be less than honest if I didn't say my wife had to be forgiven a few times. Quite recently. I understand she has divulged a secret. I'm glad that so soon after her speaking engagement to the women and the mother and daughter banquet last Friday night, that I have equal time. But seriously, being forgiving is an absolute essential part of perpetuating love. I've met individuals who found it impossible to forgive. And, you know, forgiveness is a result of our spiritual relationship to God. The Bible says, "Forgive as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you." And when he forgives, he does the one thing that determines forgiveness. I've had people say to me, How can I tell whether I've really forgiven my partner? Very simply, have you forgotten it? If you can't forget the deed, then you haven't forgiven. And you say, well, why haven't I forgiven? I've had people tell me, well, I've prayed and asked God to make me forgive. Well, quit asking God to make you forgive and forgive. You see, God never commands us to do something He won't enable us to do. And the reason people don't forgive an affront or an insult, now you won't like this, but it's true. The reason they don't is because they just don't want to. I had a handsome fella in Indianapolis and a very attractive woman. They were both the same age as Bev and myself, and I couldn't help but think how Jesus Christ had changed our whole lives. He said, could I see you privately? We were having a seminar there, and while Dr. Brandt was speaking, I met them in the pastor's study. And as they told me about their family, they had been Christians now for about 18 months. And their family was just shambles because they did not know Jesus when their children were little. And you can't help but hear a story like that of someone your own age and just thank God that your life was different because of Jesus. In any case, as they explained their situation, after he became a Christian, he thought he was given some very poor advice. He thought that he'd better level with his wife and tell her everything he had done wrong. And then it got so messy that she developed a spiritual problem. And for 18 months, they had not been living together as husband and wife. And so he said, we need help. I thought that was the understatement of the year. And as we talked, she quickly started in telling me about all of these things. And he had already told me, said, everything she'll tell you is true. Said, I know because I told her what she'll tell you. Said, she's told every counselor we've gone to. And she started in. She had a little 25-minute speech that she gave in 15 minutes. And when she got all through, I only had a few more minutes with her, and I saw the misery and the coldness and the hardness on her face, and I prayed and said, Lord, what should I say to this lady? And so I dealt with her on the subject of forgiveness, and she said, I can't forgive him. And I said, may I ask you a question? Do you want to be happy or miserable the rest of your life? And she said, well, of course, I've come here because I want to be happy. And I said, well, happiness only comes by obeying God's principles. And one of His principles is, you must forgive. You must forgive. Anytime you refuse to forgive, you're doing the opposite. You're carrying a grudge. And if you carry that grudge, you will carry it to your grave and to your marital ruination. I believe nothing will destroy love greater than a lack of forgiveness. All right, seventh. Avoid comparisons. Avoid comparisons. It is unjustifiable, unreal, and unreasonable to compare your partner with someone else. And yet it's amazing how frequently it's done. And whenever you compare someone with someone else, you are given the privilege of fantasizing. And we all look better in a fantasy, don't we? When you compare your husband or your wife with someone else's husband and wife, number one, it's wrong. And by the way, it tells me that you've got a mental attitude sin problem to begin with. You're not dealing in a real world. God always has us deal in a real world with real persons. But in any case, when you do that, you only know the good of another person. And you've got to compare them with a whole, if you were to compare at all. I suggest that you avoid unreal comparisons. It's like the farmer whose wife repeatedly nagged him and groaned about why he wasn't like the friend down the street, until finally it irritated him so much he hired a detective to follow that fellow night and day. And then one day when his wife came off with that he was ready for, he said, you've been after me for years to be like the fellow down the street. I'd just like to tell you what kind of a guy he is. And he told her about the three women he'd had affairs with. Now he says, do you really want me to be like that? Now, I don't suggest you hire a detective to protect yourself, but just avoid unfair or comparisons or any kind of comparisons. All right, number 8. Be willing to adjust. Willing to adjust. One of the hallmarks of a mature person is that they are willing to adjust. You can't have everything your way. And, you know, I have found that your partner's way really isn't too bad sometimes. Sometimes. I don't think there's any secret around the church that I hate fried chicken. And do you know, in the last year, I've been tampering with my dislike for fried chicken, and I've found there's one kind that I like. I won't advertise the brand. It doesn't need any advertising. But do you know where I learned that? After about 30 years of detesting chicken. I really didn't like it in high school, and when I got in the Air Force and they didn't always take the feathers off us, that really got it. But one day I realized that I was indulging in a real selfishness. My wife would never serve chicken in our home, and it was because I just didn't like it. And so we got pressed for time, and so I went out to pick up something warm, and she told me where they had some barbecue things that we could all eat. And I thought, well, I'm going to surprise her. And brought her home the first fried chicken that we'd had as a family. And, you know, it was such an enjoyable experience. I really enjoyed that chicken. But to this day, that's the only brand I can enjoy. Nine, strive to understand your partner. Strive to understand your partner. All of us are the victims of a background. Now, that isn't an excuse for our behavior, but it certainly is an indication that our actions and reactions are not spontaneous. And when your partner does those things that irritate and aggravate you, it's helpful to try to understand them. Instead of browbeating them, and trying to change them to understand your partner, it helps you to keep love alive. I have found the study of temperament to be very fascinating because it helps you to understand your partner, that it's not a personal reason that they act or react as they do, but it's just a part of their temperament. And then 10, be patient. I find it instructive that in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the first description of love is love suffereth long. Well, now that's an old English word for patient. Now, patience is going to show itself in modified acceptance of another person's erratic behavior. The opposite of that is anger, isn't it? An ill-tempered person, an impatient person is going to get mad and blow up. And some of us have our emotions closer to the surface in that regard. But if we love our partner more than we love ourselves, then we're going to develop patience. Isn't it amazing how a fella can be patient before marriage? I'll take, for example, something that all you fellas, or not all of you, but most of you have neglected or forgotten to do, and that is open doors for your wife. Isn't it interesting you open doors for her before you were married? Just, you know, 10,000 doors, wherever you went, you just open a door for her, and you beat her to the restaurant door so that you could be kind to her and show your interest in her and your attention, because that was meaningful to her. It's astonishing how many men find, after they're married, that they lose that motivation. They feel a little bit peculiar, and so they just indulge that rather embarrassing thing and just let her shift for herself. And I suggest that you not regard what is meaningful to you, but what is meaningful to her. And I haven't found a woman yet that didn't respond to some patience. In fact, I mean politeness as an expression of patience. As I travel around, I find that there is less of an indication on the part of women today to expect politeness and consideration. And it seems that they're even more astonished when it's extended. It's my opinion that a Christian man should be a leader in this regard. 11, trust each other. Love is going to trust a partner. Isn't that what it says in 1 Corinthians 13? Love has faith and trust. It relies on. And I find that nothing destroys your love for a person than the suspicions of the mind. I remember in Florida, I was having lunch with some friends, and across from me was a lovely Southern belle whose handsome husband was a boat builder. And I'll never forget, as the din of voices around the table were obliterating any distinct sounds except those to whom you were speaking, and she said, "May I ask you a question? Would you explain to me why it is I am so jealous of my husband? When I'm sound and in my right mind like I am today, I know that my jealousy is not grounded on fact." And then she told me this story. Here he is in this booming boat business, and he's really getting it off the ground, and everything's going right for him. And she becomes suspicious of his secretary. And in an effort to prove to her there was nothing going on with the secretary, he said, "Listen, that gal in the business world is like my right arm, but if it's that important to you, I'll fire her tomorrow." And so she said, "Okay, fire her tomorrow." He said, "All right, on one condition, that you'll come in and take her place." And she said, "All right, I will." So he brought his wife into the business, and she worked there. And she said, "Do you know, I had him fire two other women employees before I went to my doctor." And he looked at her and said, "Did it ever occur to you that you might be the problem and not your husband?" And then she got a chance to look at herself objectively. "Why, no, it wasn't the three women." He had never really done anything to give her suspicion. He was a fine Christian leader. And she said, "Now, why is it that without one shred of evidence, I distrust my husband?" Well, I'm not a genius when it comes to analyzing people, but I've learned a trick that anyone can use. It's called watch and pray. I looked her straight in her eyes, and I prayed a very profound prayer. It went something like this: "Lord, what in the world am I going to ask this woman next?" And I have found when I throw up that emergency prayer, he has never failed to give me exactly the right question. And so I said to her, "What do you really think of yourself?" And she said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Do you like yourself?" She said, "Not really." And here is an attractive woman who thought she was really kind of ugly, thought she married over her head, and was always running in her mind to try and keep up with her handsome, outgoing, gregarious husband. The problem was not him. The problem was in her suspicious heart. Again, you come back, of course, to the spiritual problem. Number 12. You know, each one of these would make a good sermon. Why don't you invite me back next month? Number 12. Become friends. Do things together. It's important to develop a together spirit. And you'll find that things you once loved, you can learn to dislike. And things you disliked at one time, you can learn to enjoy. And as you go through life, you'll find that you will become good friends, or you just won't have anything in common and you won't have a marriage at all. If I may be indulged this personal warm experience. We got a letter from our son when he was in Hawaii. He had been married all of 5 months, and he was telling us how fantastic it was to be married. And we had a little idea of what he meant. And he summed it all up by saying, "It just dawned on me the other day that Kathy is my best friend." And I looked at my wife and I said, "Hey, it looks like he's got the message." When your wife or your husband is your best friend, it's because you enjoy their company. Now, you may not have enjoyed that much exposure in your youth, but as you grow older, you have more and more of a life expression in common, and you can learn to enjoy each other. Become good friends, because as Dr. Brandt says, if you live to be 50, to be married about 50 years, you spend twice as much time together as you did with children. Think about that. All right, number 13. Spend some time apart. That doesn't sound like me, does it? But I think it's good for us to spend some time apart. Not too much, just a little bit, to let you know what it's like to sleep all alone some night. A couple of nights in a row, and I do it enough to where I find that something must go on while I'm gone, because it's always great to get back home. I appreciate her. She appreciates me. And there's something about a review opportunity when you're apart for just little snatches. Don't overdo it, but a little bit. And then 14, take brief vacations together, particularly if you have children in the home. Occasionally through the years, she needs to get away from the children. She needs to go back to what it was like when the two of you started courting. You know, one of the problems with marriage is it's kind of like a pressure cooker. You don't have too many problems when you're courting. You just go around and you see each other under ideal conditions, and you can talk incessantly about everything, and you don't have to make any big decisions. You drive her up and say goodnight, and then her father has to pay her bills, and he has to make the big decisions. But you know, when you get home from the honeymoon, it's a different ball game. Suddenly you've got to decide whether it's going to be an $85 a month apartment or a $145 a month apartment, and whether you're going to have two bathrooms or one, or whether you're going to have a garage, or whether what color of walls and the furniture, and whether, you know, there are just a jillion decisions that you have to make. And then there's family decisions. And it seems that you never can get away from pressures. And the man may want to bring his business home from the office, and the wife has her activities and interests, or the children. And consequently, you don't have those carefree moments. And believe me, it's essential every now and then to leave your troubles, no matter how old they are, at home with a good relative preferably, or a good reliable babysitter, so that you can get away for a weekend in a motel room where you don't have to cut the hedges and you don't have to do the lawn, and you can just be together and relax and have fun. That's the way it started. And one of the problems of marriage pressure cooker is that the experience you have over the long haul is so much different from the ideal circumstances under which you courted. I've recommended this to a number of couples to find that it was a great help to them. Now, after you've done it the first time, just for fun, then the second time, may I suggest that away from the home, you can be more objective and evaluate some of the things that you should do when you go back to improve your relationship. Maybe to improve your discipline with the children and your spiritual walk with God. Many a couple have gone away on a weekend and found it to be a very stimulating spiritual experience, where they could read the Word together and pray together and talk to God about how to orient their lives. It may sound a little stuffy and stilted if you've never tried it. I suggest you try it. You'll like it. And then 15... enjoy your children together. Now, I'm assuming you're having children. The only reason you shouldn't have children is because God, by His sovereign wisdom, makes it impossible. But I don't think you attend this church very long, but what you know, we believe our Heavenly Father designed us to propagate after our own kind. And the sublime experience of expressing our love in the God-ordained plan that brings forth other creatures with a destiny, a free will, and an eternal soul, and the power to propagate is just a phenomenal gift. And you will find that your greatest enjoyment in life will be in raising your children and enjoying them together. In fact, may I be indulged? Well, since I have the microphone, what choice do you have? But today, just today, my lovely married daughter came across the church parking lot, and I was rushing to go to a place, and she brought the cutest little granddaughter I have ever seen. And she said, "Dad, I've got a surprise for you," and she gave me this picture. And as I walked out, I gave her a big hug, And then she pulled out another one in the frame, and she said, I was in your office the other day, and I see that you've got Kathy and my picture there when we were married, and I just thought I'd give you a picture of another of your girls. And so now in my study, I have that picture. But as I walked down the sidewalk from that quick interchange, it couldn't have lasted more than a minute and a half because I had someone waiting for me, I thought to myself, LaHaye, you sure are a rich man. I thank God for children and the times we had together. Don't waste those times. If your children are still in the home, plan times together. The whole world is against you. Everything, our whole system, I don't know if somebody has planned it that way, but the whole mercantile system is against your spending time with your children. You just have to be the master of that situation and refuse to let the world cheat you or even your friends cheat you out of time spent with your children. There is no substitute for time with your family. And then 16, I've only got three to go. I heard somebody yawn, so just stay awake. 16, avoid financial slavery. Every book on marriage that you'll ever find has as number one enemy in the home money problems. I don't believe it. I think it's number three or four, but it's right up there. It is a very common problem. And in our country, it is astonishing the overwhelming majority of people who have been brought into the slavery of credit buying. Buy now and pay later. Well, you'd think that was good for the economy, wouldn't you, the way they advertise it? Well, it may be good for the bankers and the merchants' economy, but it sure isn't good for yours. You overspend, you overcommit, and you bring yourself into the pressure cooker of what are we going to do now? So that when you have those choice moments at home with a family, you're under the burden of payments and finances and pressures that are just unreal. I suggest that you burn your credit cards and maintain the best credit rating you can so that you don't have to use it, and only buy what you can afford. You'll find that the freedom is a rich freedom indeed. And then 17, keep your roles straight. Keep your roles straight. And the Bible roles are the only roles to follow. Where the Bible teaches, as I mentioned on Sunday, the husband is the head of the wife, and the wife is to be in submission to her husband, and the husband is to love his wife. Men, you are responsible to God to love your wife. She is responsible to God to be in submission to you. And you will never find a happy home that does not function that way. Every now and then I have someone who comes and shares with me a personal illustration. When I was in Chicago in a seminar several months ago, a lady came up to me and I had spoken on the matter of submission and how men are more egotistical than women and that a man can't stand not being the head of his home. And I mentioned the fact that I have never seen a happy henpecked man in my life, nor for that matter have I ever seen a happy henpecker. And after the meeting was over, a lady came up to me and she said, I'd like to give you a testimonial, if I may. We have been married 22 years, 10 very happy years. And I stopped and I said, Well, what did you do that made the last 10 years different from the first 12? She said, the first 12 years I competed with my husband because I have a more forceful personality than he. But one day, and this is one of the joys of going to church, you know, sometimes you hear things and it doesn't mean anything to you, and then all of a sudden you hear something and a light bulb goes on. She said, I went to church one Sunday morning and the pastor was preaching on the family, and he pointed out from Ephesians 5 that if I am ever going to be a spiritual woman, I have to be in submission to my husband. She said, for the first time, I realized why. She said, I'm smarter than he is. I have more common sense. I can make better decisions. I mean, talk about understanding your role. But she said, for the first time, I realized that I had to be in submission to my husband because God said so. She said, I went home and I got down on my knees and told the Lord I was wrong all these years and that I'd need his help to be a submissive wife. And she said, my husband has changed from being an unkind, passive, cold, indifferent man to being a gracious, warm, outgoing man that is easier for me to love. And these last 10 years have been the greatest years of our marriage. Now that strange story can be illustrated by many similar stories that I've met around the country. Submission is the only way to go. All right, number 18, and this one is the last one. You'll like this one, and I want you to remember it. It's very important. Compliment and praise each other every day. Compliment and praise each other every day. Just recently, I had a man tell me all the things that were wrong with his wife. I mean, he had them all classified. He didn't even need notes. He just went right down the list. And I said, just ignoring those things, I said, could you name some things that you like about your wife? And he started in, and he mentioned two or three, and he strained and mentioned a couple more. And I said, let's make a list. And so we made a list together. Finally, exhausting his mind and his capabilities, he worked out a list of 10 things. And then I said, how would you like to try an experiment? I think it'll help you. And he said, all right, I'm game for anything. He's a Christian man, a young Christian. Said, would you read this list every morning, and as you do it out loud, in a prayerful attitude, thank God for each of these 10 things? He said, do you think it'll work? I said, I think it'll help. I'm confident it would help, you know. It may not cure everything, I wasn't sure, but I knew it was a better mental attitude than he'd been indulging in before. Do you know that in three weeks, their entire relationship was changed? And he had not purposely verbalized it yet. He was just reading them out loud to himself. But he said, do you know, she has already picked up the feeling of my attitude, that it's improved. Why? Because he was thanking God about the positive and not griping in his mind about the negative. It's important that you not only think it, but that you say it. As I indicated at the outset, everyone loves to be loved, but everyone loves to be approved. Have you ever said to your wife, honey, I'm sure glad I married you? Now, you may have your own little facetious way you slip in your personality. I always tell my wife, hon, I'm sure glad I turned down those other thousands of offers. I try to reassure her what a good deal she got. But have you ever noticed how you are thrilled when your wife or your husband appreciates what you've done or what you've said or how you've acted in a given situation? Well, it's just that important to them to hear it from you. Some time ago, I was reading in a newspaper the reporter's interview. Maybe you read it too. I thought it was a charming story of a man and his wife who had been married over 50 years, and the reporter interviewed them. And typical fashion, they put it way in the back of the newspaper. And yet I found it accidentally. And the reporter said to him, what is the secret to your happiness in marriage all these 50 years? Because the man had indicated it had been a very happy life. And he said, it was a result of a gift her father gave me when we were married. He said, when Sally and I were married, she came from a home where her dad loved her dearly and she loved her dad. And I knew it was very hard when he gave his daughter to me. And with his daughter, he gave me this pocket watch. And with that, he reached in his hand and pulled out this gold watch, one of those old kind that you press the top and the cover pops up. And he said, for he had engraved on the face of this watch, say something nice to Sally today. And he said, for 50 years, I have made it a point, every time I looked at that watch, to ask myself, have I said something nice to Sally today? And he said, the strange thing is, every time I say something nice to Sally, she says something nice to me. That's the secret of their happiness. And they've been at it for 50 years. I hope you have a secret and that you use it.